Thank you, everyone, for joining us again this week for the second class in Shuli's series with Torah in Motion, Stones and Stories, A Journey Through Biblical Archaeology. To go ahead, Shuli.
Thank you, Maxine. Hi, everybody. So last week, we looked at kind of a larger picture of the Book of Joshua. This week, we're going to zero in on a very important story and use the area around it as useful for just to discuss a few other things that are connected to the story. So we skipped over the story of the blessings and the curses, the covenant on Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And this is really a very fascinating area that comes up later on in Tanakh. So I'm going to take the liberty of skipping ahead and talking about that as well. So we're going to talk about the story in the Book of Joshua of Gerizim and Ebal, but we're also going to talk about the Shomron and the Samaritans, and the story of the Samaritans, which doesn't happen until the Book of Kings, but we're going to do it now because we're in the area. We're also going to talk about Shechem and the importance of Shechem. So the picture is just a great picture from, I don't know, probably about 100 years ago, of this Shomroni, this Samaritan, sitting in a nice little secluded area on Mount Gerizim. The connection between our stories is that the Samaritan community sees Mount Gerizim as their holy mountain, right? They see it as the Mount Moriah, right? That for them, it's the place of the temple. And we're going to see that as we go through both in their approach to the Torah and in where they situate themselves and where they build their temple. But first, let's understand where we are. Okay. Sources I know Maxine put in the chat. So if people want to look at that, we're going to be using that in a few minutes. But let's understand where we are. So if last time we really were kind of all over the place and we were looking at the conquest and entering the land from the east, and the various attacks, whether in the center of the country, in the north of the country, right? We talked about the Givonim. Today we're really focusing on one area, and that is the area right near Shechem or Nablus, as it is in this map, in the Google Maps, right? Where we have two mountains, one on either side, right? We have Gerizim over here. We have Ebal over here. We're going to see Shechem comes from the word shoulders, right? And the mountains are the shoulders and Shechem is in the center, is in the middle. Okay. So we're going to be talking about those, and the valley in between and the importance of that valley. We're also going to be looking at a third mountain, which is right by the modern community of Elon Moret. And that mountain is called Har Kabir. I'm going to show you a picture of it in a second. And from that mountain, you have a great view of the other two, right? So we have a nice little triangle here of the three mountains. There is a suggestion that Mount Gerizim is not located over here, but is actually Kabir. We'll talk about that in a minute. Don't worry about that at the moment. Shechem, Nablus, as it's written here, is really, we think of it as, well, I'm never going to go there, right? It's right deep in the middle of a Palestinian area. It's not so friendly. This is true. But it is also true that Shechem is very much in the center of the country, right? It is on the main road that goes through the mountains, right? The path of the patriarchs, the Derech Ha'avot, right? Here's Shiloh down here. Beit El is further down. Jerusalem is further down. This is the major road that cuts through the center of the country. It's also not too far from the Jordan Valley on this side and from the coast on this side. And if you really wanted to like take out a map of the land of Israel and pinpoint the center place, Shechem is a pretty good bet. Right. It really is a very, very significant place because of what's going on in the modern world and politics and Jews and Arabs. Shechem has lost its natural standing as Rav Yitzchak Levi calls it, as the uncrowned capital of the land of Israel. And we're going to come back to Shechem, but that's the area that we're in. And again, just to be aware of how close it is to the Jordan Valley, that's going to be important in our story of how do the Israelites come in when they come across from Jordan, when they cross the Jordan, how do they get up here to do the blessings and the curses? Okay. So we're going to keep that in mind, I hope, as we go on. Let's just take a look at, this mountain. So this is the third mountain that I mentioned before, the one that's by Elon Moret, Mount Kabir. Okay, Kabir is just another word for great or enormous. And the truth is all of these mountains are very large, particularly Har Eval, but Har Kabir is also a very large, very impressive mountain. This is up here at the top. There's what's called a Kever Sheikh, right? A grave of an important Muslim leader. This is Sheikh Bilal, who was reputed to be the muezzin, the caller to prayer of Muhammad. Right? And he is supposed to be buried up here. This is in the area of the Jewish community of Elon Moret, which was built in the 70s after the Six-Day War. So this is not so much of a Muslim shrine anymore because it's within the Jewish community. And from now Kabir, and this is really one of those tours where you say, we don't want to be here on Zoom. We really want to be in real life because the view from Mount Kabir is extraordinary. It's an unbelievable sight where you look out and you have this incredible 360 view, right? To the west, you have Gizim and Eval and Shechem in the middle. To the north, as we're going to see in a minute, we have the Tirza Valley that goes all the way out to the Jordan Valley, right? You really can just see in so many different directions. It's a very significant place. And here's where we're going to go into the commandment of what is this story of the blessings and the curses, right? Up until now, we talked about the book of Joshua. We talked about entering the land, doing it in a very specific way, right? With the Torah going in front of us, the first commandments of circumcision and Pesach, right? This kind of very covenantal entering into the land. But we skipped over the main part of the covenant, which is the story that happens by Gerizim and Eval, which we are already commanded in the Torah, right? Two different places. We're going to look at two different Torah sources, both from the book of Deuteronomy, from Devarim, okay? We're also going to look at the Samaritan version of the Torah, which is only slightly different. Okay, we'll talk about the Samaritans and the Torah soon. Don't worry, but we will get to it. But meanwhile, let's just look at what it says here. So in the book of Devarim, chapter 11, it shall come to pass when the Lord your God shall bring you into the land where you go to possess it. This is an old translation, so don't mind the withers and the vows. You shall set the blessing upon Mount Gerizim and the curse upon Mount Eval. Okay, now the details of what this means are going to be in our second paragraph, a few chapters later. But what we have in this first section is very clear directions of where Gerizim and Eval are. Now, remember, Moses, never been in the land of Israel, speaking to the children of Israel, never been in the land of Israel, right? They're going into an unknown area. How are they going to know where this is? So he says, he gets it from God, obviously. Are they not beyond the Jordan, behind the way of the going down of the sun, in the land of the Canaanites that dwell in the Arava, over against Gilgal, besides the terebinths of Moreh? Now, it's fascinating because it is a very detailed description of where to go. And yet, the Gemara discusses where this is. And they're not so clear. When we say beyond the Jordan, does it mean towards the east of the Jordan, closer to the west of the Jordan? Are we in the where the sun goes down, where the sun comes up? The Gemara goes in all different directions because they're trying to figure out the technicalities of how this is going to work. How are they going to do this on the day, which we're going to see in our second source in a minute, on the day that they cross into the land? The two places are not next to each other. Okay. But before that, take a look at the Samaritan version of the Torah. Okay. Now the Samaritans, as we're going to see, have the five books of Moses and the book of Joshua. Everything else, the other books of Tanakh, they do not accept as Torah. And obviously Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Mishnah, the Gemara, they do not accept as Torah. Their version of the Torah is mostly like our version of the Torah. However, it places the emphasis on the area that they see as holy. So instead of just this nice directional verse, which seems very clear, are they not beyond the Jordan, behind the way of the going down the sun, et cetera, et cetera, they add two words at the end, which are not in the original Torah. Opposite Shechem. Don't get confused. It's right near Shechem. Shechem is easy, right? We know where that is. That's much more clear than Elon Moreh, which was a much less important place. Okay? So they make sure you're going to go to that place that's near Shechem. Don't forget, it's near Shechem. We're going to see they're going to be even more clear in our next one. Now, in the second verse, we get more details, right? This is quite a few chapters later. Devarim 27. Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, keep the commandments which I command you this day. It shall be on the day when you pass over the Jordan into the land. Right? This is what the Gemara has trouble with. How are we doing all that on one day? You shall set up, you know, we're going to pay attention here. We're going to have three different things that have to happen. You shall set up great stones and plaster them with plaster. You shall write upon them the words of the law when you have passed over, that you may go into the land which the Lord gives you. When you pass over the stones, which I command you this day on Mount Ebal, and you shall plaster them with plaster and build an altar unto the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall lift no iron tool upon them. It also talks about the blessings and the curses. So we have three things you have to do: blessings and curses, right? And we have many details about that, what you're supposed to say, the different tribes. I didn't bring it all for you. Feel free to look up the sources yourselves. Okay, blessings and curses. A great stone that the Torah is going to be written on, or a few stones, in fact, and an altar that you have to put up on Mount Ebal. Three very important things. We're going to come back to two of them. The stone with the Torah, we don't really have any proof or anything exciting to say about it, unfortunately. But the other two are very interesting. But notice that even though in other parts we hear that Mount Gerizim is the mountain of blessing and Mount Ebal is the mountain of curses, where do you build your altar, your Mizbeach? On Mount Ebal, right? And Adam Zartal, who discovered the altar on Mount Ebal, says this is to show you the power of choice in Judaism, that the mountain that's supposedly cursed can also be the mountain that has the altar on it. But the Samaritans don't like that. Right? The Samaritans want the holy mountain to stay Gerizim, right? I'm going to erase that because it covered up my words. Okay. The Samaritan version of the Torah, you shall be when you pass over the Jordan, you shall set up these stones, which I command you this day on Mount Gerizim, and you shall plaster them with plaster, completely contradicting what we have here. We don't like Ebal. We like Gerizim. Okay. So far we have, what do we have from the Torah? We have three different things you need to do. More or less the place you need to do them, and kind of a changing around of the Samaritans of what is supposed to be done where. Okay, let's see what actually happens, right? We have all this nice introduction, and then in the book of Joshua, after all this introduction, it's a little anticlimactic, we just have at the very end of the chap of the eighth chapter, really, it seems almost like an afterthought, even though it's such an important thing. We have what happens. Okay. At that time, Joshua built an altar to the Lord on Mount Ebal, right? Like the Torah says, make an altar on Mount Ebal, as is written in the book of teachings of Moses, right? We know that an altar of unhewn stone, right? All the classic things you need to know about an altar. No iron has been wielded, right? It has to be field stones, not hewn stones. They offered on it burnt offerings to the Lord and brought sacrifices. He inscribed on the stones a copy of the teaching, right? So we have altar, we have Torah. Whoever is accidentally writing on the text, don't. And so we have the altar, we have the writing, and then all Israel's stranger and citizen alike, with their elders, officials, and magistrates, stood on either side of the ark, facing the Levitical priests who carried the ark of the Lord's covenant. Half of them faced Mount Gerizim, half of them faced Mount Ebal, as Moses had commanded, in order to bless the people. And he read the words of the teaching, the blessing and the curse, just as is written in the book of the teachings. There was not a word of all that Moses has commanded that Joshua failed to read in the presence of the entire assembly of Israel, including the women and children and the strangers who accompanied them. Okay, so first of all, very important that this is the culmination of all of these covenantal things that are happening, right? Carrying the Torah and doing the Brit Milah and Pesach. And here we have renewing the Brit, right? Blessings, curses, blessed are the people who are following the laws, cursed are the people who are not following the laws, including a copy of the Torah, including an altar with sacrifices to kind of sanctify the whole place. So this is a very significant moment, and it's going to be echoed to a certain extent at the end of Yoshua's life when he assembles everybody in Shechem, essentially in the same place, to renew the covenant again. So that's very important to understand in the context of everything else that's happening. When does it happen? Okay. If we want to take the book of Joshua as written in chronological order, what's chapter 8? Chapter 8 is the story of the Ai, right? We have the battle in Jericho. Then we have two battles in the Ai. One is a defeat. One is a victory. And then we have this story. So it seems to be happening sort of partway into their journey into the land. However, we also heard in the Torah on that day, remember, it's supposed to happen right then, exactly at that moment. So the Gemara and Sotah goes through all different kinds of conversations about this. And finally, the Tosfot in Sotah is actually the nicest summing up of all the different opinions. That's why I brought it to you here. You could go through the Gemara. It's very long. But here it says opposite Gilgal, right? Mul Gilgal. That's the pasuk that we had before. It seems to mean a place from where you can see Gilgal. Now, remember Gilgal. We said Gilgal seems to be close to the Jordan where they cross, but maybe there's more than one Gilgal. How is that fitting with our story of Shechem? So remember we said there's more than one Gilgal. Adam Zertal, who is the one who comes up with this idea of the foot-shaped Gilgal that we talked about last time, he says there actually is a Gilgal not far from Rizim and Ebal. The Gemara doesn't know about that. So we have the Yerushalmi says, according to Rabbi Lazar, there are two hills called Grizim and Eval near Gilgal, right? Very interesting. Rabbi Lazar says, we're not talking about that Grizim and Eval, the ones near Shechem. No, no, no. There's another set of mountains that are right near the Jordan. Now, the really fascinating thing is that a few hundred years after these rabbis, we have a Byzantine map, a very famous map called the Medva map, which is a map of the land of Israel at the time of the 6th century, give or take. And that map actually has two Grizim and Eval, one in the place that we know of near Shechem and another two near the Jordan, right? So there was this tradition that it was obviously right there. They cross the Jordan. They do the blessings and curses right there. Okay, that's Rabbi Elazar. Doesn't fit with our beautiful topography that we're going to see pictures of in a moment, but it does solve our chronological problem. According to Rabbi Yehuda, they walked 120 mil in one day. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, no, no. It's the Grizim and Eval you know about. And they went back and forth. They walked all the way there from the Jordan. According to Rabbi Elazar, they did not leave their place. Okay, either way, both of these rabbis are seeing this happening that day, the day they cross the Jordan. Only for Rabbi Elazar, it's a little bit easier. For Rabbi Yehuda, he has to have some kind of a miraculous intervention. But then we have a third opinion, which is, I think, the most logical opinion. The Rishalmi also adds that Rabbi Yishmael says that all times when it says they came in the Torah, it means after 14 years, 7 of conquest and 7 of settlement. The blessings and curses were only said after those 14 years. It doesn't have to be exactly on that day. It could be in the process of entering the land. And that solves all our problems. It could easily be far away because it's not on that day. It takes them 14 years and then they gather there together. Rabbi Hanina asked Rabbi Mana, but it says when you cross the Jordan, you will put up the stones on that day. He said the stones were put up immediately, but the blessings and curses were only said after 14 years. Okay, so we have a variety of opinions just to confuse us even further and to add in one more element here. Okay. So when you are up on Mount Kabir, if you look to the north, you can see a deep valley below. And this valley is, it's a wadi. It's a riverbed called Nachal Tirza. Okay. We know that the 5 daughters of Slofchad, right, who are from the tribe of Menashe, one of them is Tirza. The more famous one is Noah because she's the one that everybody likes that name, but Tirza is also a nice name. And all of those places, Chagla Milka, right, Tirza, they're all places in the tribe of Menashe. So this is the Tirza Valley below or the Tirza Wadi. And it goes all the way out to the Jordan. Perhaps, and this is a suggestion of Rav Yitzchak Levi, perhaps when we imagine Bnei Israel crossing the Jordan, we tend to imagine them in a long line stretching back east, right? Starting at the Jordan and going deep into the country of Jordan. Perhaps we should imagine them as a long line stretched north to south, right? And it's actually a really nice image because if you picture it that way, they all cross at the same time, right? I always imagine like everybody hold hands. Hold your breath. We're going into the land of Israel, all of us at the same time. Is that what happened? I don't know. But what that would mean is that the northernmost ones are very close to Nachal Tirza. and they could walk through the valley and get to the area of the blessings and curses relatively easily. It's not that far away. It's a few hours walk. So does that solve our problems? Does that complicate our problems? It means that not the entire nation would be there. It would only be a portion of the nation, and that's a little bit of a problem, but it is a very interesting idea. Once we're looking north, the other thing that is to the north besides the beautiful scenery is there's a large Arab village called Tubas, and we think that this is the Tevets of the book of Judges, where Avimelech is killed by a woman throwing a millstone on his head, right? Avimelech, of course, is in Shechem, so Tevets being nearby, that makes sense. It's also the Valley of Dotan, which is where the story of Joseph being thrown into the pit and then sold by his brothers takes place. So this is a significant area. There's a lot going on here, right? And here's Shechem. So this is what I mentioned to you before. Right, Shechem is between the mountains. So here we have Grizim, and here we have Eval, right? And people like to say, oh, Eval is the mountain of curses, and that's why it's barren as opposed to Grizim, which is green. Okay, you could say that, but it's more a factor of topography than a factor of being blessed or cursed. Mount Eval is not a cursed mountain. Good things happen on it. There's an altar there. Okay, in between, literally in between the shoulders, is the city of Shechem. Okay, so it works very, very well. This is a view from Mount Kabir, right, where you can clearly see both mountains. Adam Zartal, who we're going to talk about in a minute, because he's the guy who found the Mizbeach, the altar, on Mount Ebal, he suggests that the Samaritans moved Mount Gerizim, moved it, right? That this mountain over here is not the true Mount Gerizim. The true Mount Gerizim is Mount Kabir over here, and he doesn't have a triangle, and he says here the valley is in the middle, but he's only one opinion. Others do not agree with that. Okay, but one of the things that you can see, it's a little hard to see from this picture just because things are far away, but you can see that the valley is kind of this nice open area between the two mountains. And if you look at satellite pictures, this is not a great satellite picture, I apologize, but it's still kind of cool. You can still see it. What are you seeing? That in the side, the northern side of Mount Gerizim, and parallel to it in the southern side of Mount Ebal, it's almost like there are two indentations in the mountain creating a natural amphitheater. Today, that's not so easy to see because Shechem is very much urban sprawl. We'll see pictures of it in a few minutes, and it's spread out to fill all these areas.
Julie?
Yeah?
My name is Diana. If people are on a computer, if they go to the view, they're able to make the pictures come closer to them.
Oh,
so they
thank
can
you.
See it better.
So you could see it better, although this is a little bit of a blurry picture.
Yeah,
so I don't know if it's going to get that much better, but that is helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's a helpful comment. Okay, so this is a little less clear to us today. However, over a century ago, there were some people who were riding through the valley who noticed this natural formation, they decided that it was clear that something was going on here, and they wanted to test out the story of the blessings and the curses. So this is a letter from somebody named J.W. McGarvey from 1879. I love this letter. Okay. He is obviously a Christian traveling through the land of Israel in Ottoman Turkish times with other Christian priests. We're going to hear about Brother Taylor and Frank and Earl. Hey, and he says, our route took us back through the valley. We resolved that while passing between the mountains, we would try the experiment of reading the blessings and curses. It is interesting to know that the spot chosen by God for this reading is a vast natural amphitheater in which the human voice can be heard to a surprising distance. About halfway between Shechem and the mouth of the valley in which it stands, there is a deep semicircular recess in the face of Mount Ebal and a corresponding one precisely opposite in Mount Gerizim. No man with his eyes open can ride along the valley without being struck with this singular formation. As soon as I saw it, I recognized it as the place of Joshua's reading, right? Again, 1879, much, much, much less built up. It has been asserted repeatedly by travelers that although two men stationed on the opposite slopes of these two mountains are a mile apart, they can read so as to be heard by each other, right? So let's just review what's supposed to happen, right? According to the Torah, you are supposed to have the Ark of the Covenant in the middle, okay, with the Kohanim, with the Leviim. On the mountain, on Gerizim, there are representatives of six tribes. On Eval, there are representatives of the other six tribes, and they're going to read out the Leviim and the Kohanim in the middle, read out the blessings and curses. The blessings, the tribes on Mount Gerizim say Amen. The curses, the tribes on Mount Eval say Amen. This is assuming that the sound is going to carry. Okay. So that's what they're going to experiment with. We prefer to try the experiment in stricter accordance with Joshua's example. I took a position, Bible in hand, in the middle of the valley. I just love imagining this. While Brother Taylor and Frank, to represent six tribes, climbed halfway up the slope of Mount Gerizim, and Brother Earl, to represent the other six tribes, took a similar position on Mount Ebal. I read, and they were to pronounce the Amen after each curse or blessing. Brother Taylor, he's on Gerizim, heard me distinctly, and I could hear his response. But Brother Earl, though he could hear my voice, could not distinguish the words. This was owing to the fact that some terrace walls on the side of the mountain prevented him from ascending high enough, and the trees between me and him interrupted the passage of the sound. The experiment makes it perfectly obvious that if Joshua had had a strong voice, which I have not, he could have been heard by his audience without the assistance of the Levites. As to the space included in the amphitheaters, I think it ample to accommodate the 600,000 men with their families, although of this I cannot be certain. If more space was required, the aid of the Levites was indispensable. Okay, so here we have our natural amphitheater and the reading out of the blessings and the curses. But now let's get to the story of Eval and of Adam Zartal. So Adam Zartal was a fascinating person, archaeologist, 1936 to 2015. As you can see in the picture here, he is on crutches. Adam Zartal served in the Yom Kippur War. Okay, he was a relatively young man, right? Less than 30 years old. And he was seriously wounded more than 30 years old. He was seriously wounded in the Yom Kippur War. And while he was recuperating, he came up with the very unlikely choice that he wanted to be an archaeologist. He knew that he was never going to walk normally again, but he wanted to be an archaeologist. And in fact, another archaeologist named Yoram Safrir, who had also been wounded 6 years earlier in the Six-Day War, he came and he encouraged him, and Zartal studied and he became an archaeologist, but he didn't become an archaeologist sitting at a desk. He became an archaeologist who walked more miles in this land than about 10 of us put together. And his greatest project was a survey of the area of Samaria. Okay, after the Six-Day War, the Shomron, Samaria is opened up, is under Israeli control. And here's this place that's the heartland, right? So much of the stories of Tanakh and of so many different peoples take place in this area and had never really been fully explored. And what he does is he undertakes, obviously with a lot of help, not just by himself, this heroic survey where they basically just walk the land of the Shomron. And he describes it, what he would do. He would go with, I don't know, 10 students, 15 students. They would spread out in a field, right, in a line, and they would just walk across the field. And whenever they saw something that was of interest, right, maybe a piece of an ancient wall, a terrace or something, they would mark it down so as to know what would be worth exploring. And this survey is of invaluable importance, not just in discovering the big discoveries, right, like what we're going to see, the story of Har Eval, but also in charting things like settlement patterns, right, like understanding where are the first Israelite settlements? They start out in the east and they move to the west, right? By seeing where they are and their chronology, and getting the bigger picture is really a fascinating thing. So Adam Zartal does this survey, and in 1980, the site on Mount Eval, right? Everybody knows what Mount Eval is, but they didn't know that there was an archaeological site there. In 1980, it was discovered. And from 82 through 90, it's excavated. And what they discover on Mount Ebal, which Zertal doesn't realize at first, and it takes the aid of a member of the religious yeshuv where they were sleeping, where the archaeological contingent was sleeping. He kind of sketched out on a napkin that they found something that looked like this. And the guy is so excited, and he jumps up from the dining room table, and he runs to get a Mishnah. And he comes back with a Mishnah Midot with illustrations. And he says, you found an altar. You found a Mizbeach. This is what it looks like, right? It has the corners. It has the ramp. It has the Yesod, right? The area around it. So he finds this compound. The compound itself is 9 meters long, 7 meters wide, 4 meters high. Okay. And inside the compound, he found two altars, one on top of the other, and the whole thing covered by a layer of stones, right? So what we think this is, and it's fascinating because it is clearly an altar. There are bones underneath it. There are ashes underneath it. It has this ramp going up to it. And there are a few things that make him conclude that this is really the altar that Joshua built. Number one, it is an Israelite altar and not a Canaanite altar. How do we know that? Because the bones of all the animals that are discovered here are kosher animals. Not all of them are sacrificial animals, by the way. Okay, there's something called a yachmor, which is not an animal that we use as a sacrifice, but it is a kosher animal. Okay, no pigs, nothing that is not kosher. Not only that, it has a ramp going up to it, right? And the Torah specifically says you have to have a ramp to go up to your altar and not steps. The Canaanites had steps. Okay. The altar is covered up with stones. It's put in Geniza, right? It's not destroyed. Why? Because the holy place on Mount Ebal is a temporary thing. And the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is going to be set up in Shiloh. And this is not going to be a holy place anymore. And how does he date it to the time of Joshua? He dates it by two scarabs, right? Those Egyptian symbols that are found here that date to the time of Ramses II, right? Ramses II is the Paro of the Exodus. Most people agree. Not everyone agrees with Zertal that this is Joshua's altar, but many people do. And the evidence is really very strong. Zertal says that from the altar, you cannot see the Mount Gerizim that we call Mount Gerizim today. And that's why he relocates Mount Gerizim to Mount Kabir. But others say, no, it's not such a problem, right? Remember what we said, the blessings and the curses and the Mizbeach do not have to have happened simultaneously. They don't have to all be done by the same people at the same time. But it's a very, very exciting discovery. And like I said, not everybody agrees with it, but Zertal wrote a very powerful book about this whole story. He was not a religious man by any means, but he did place a lot of faith in biblical sources. He wrote a great book called Am Nolad, which I believe has been translated into English, where he talks about this moment as this incredibly important covenantal moment, and the altar being on Mount Ebal, like I said before, as an element of free will, a free choice, that even the bad mountain, even the cursed mountain, can be the one that can have the altar on it. So very, very interesting. One last thing about this time. Well, we're going to talk about a few other things, but the story of Yosef, right? If you're following Parshat HaShavua, right, a few weeks ago, at the end of Bereshit, at the end of the book of Genesis, after the sons of Jacob bury him in Canaan, and then Joseph is dying, and he says, Pakod Yivkod Elokim Etchem, God is going to redeem you from this place, he's going to take you out of this place, and then take my bones with you. Right. And just in last week's parsha, as the Jews, as the Israelites are getting ready to leave Egypt, right, what does Moses do? He goes and he takes the bones of Joseph. It says it very, very clearly. We have a lot of interesting midrashim about how he finds them and how they rise up from the Nile. But the text itself says he took Atzmot Yosef, right? Because Yosef made the children of Israel promise that they would take his bones to the land of Israel. And this is a sign that the redemption is really happening. Okay, fine. So they take them. They schlep them through the desert. All of that is very nice. But what happens to them, and what happens with them, we only find out at the very end of the book of Joshua. The bones bones of Joseph, which the Israelites had brought it from Egypt, were buried at Shechem in the piece of ground which Jacob had bought for 100 kesita from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, and which had become a heritage of the Josephites, right? We know that Jacob gives this area of Shechem to Joseph. The promise is fulfilled. He is placed here. Why is Joseph here? When we talk about the meaning of Shechem, we'll understand that a little more. But this is Joseph's tomb quite a long time ago when there was nothing else around it. Today, Joseph's tomb looks a little bit different. It is deep in the urban sprawl of Shechem. Right. Here we go. Right over here. Right in the area, the oldest part of Shechem, Tel Balata, which we're going to talk about in a second, which is a refugee camp. Joseph's tomb is a very complicated place today because it is deep in the heart of Shechem. It shows us what would have happened, I think, in Hebron to Maran HaMachpelah, to the Cave of the Patriarchs, if Jews had not insisted on staying there, because Joseph's tomb has basically become a battleground. People may remember the very beginning of the Second Intifada, September of 2000, when the tomb was surrounded by Palestinians who attacked the soldiers who were there, and a Druze soldier, Madhat Yosef, was wounded and fatally wounded. He was killed before anybody could come to rescue him and to save him. So, and from that point on, Joseph's tomb deep in the heart of Shechem is not easily accessible. The army does provide access to it every once in a while, but usually it's in the middle of the night and under heavy guard, and it's not an easy place to get to at all. So that's the story of Joseph's tomb. So let's take a look at Shechem for a minute, right? Shechem is in the middle, as we said, between the valleys. Shechem, as I said before, it's this uncrowned capital, right? It's a very, very important place. It's the gateway into the land. Right? If you remember the story of Jacob, right? When Jacob comes back after his years with Laban and Haran, and he comes in by Shechem. He crosses over the Jordan. He comes into the land. It's where he tells his family, leave your idols behind, right? Shechem is the place where you are entering into the land and you have to decide, am I here? Am I not here? And that's why Joseph being buried in Shechem is very important, because Joseph is the guardian to the gateway. Joseph is the one who was able to keep his identity in Egypt, right, in foreign climes, and so he can kind of be the guardian of the gateway. Now, on the one hand, Shechem has all these positive things, right? The blessings and curses happen here, and it's this, like we said, the place you leave behind idols. It's a very important natural capital. On the other hand, it's a city where a lot of terrible things have happened, right? Joseph is sold very close to here. It's the place where the Israelites divide up into the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah, right? This is where that division really happens. And you have the story of Abimelech. You have a lot of the story of Dinah, right? You have a lot of difficult stories happening in Shechem. So it's not the simplest place. It's a very powerful, it was always a very powerful, very important city. The origins of it, the beginnings of the city are in Tel Balata, which is the Tel of Shechem, which is in a refugee camp today in the middle of the city, and thereby kind of impossible to excavate. It was excavated in the beginning of the century by Germans, then when it was under Jordanian control by the Americans in the 50s and the 60s. And what was discovered is a city that goes all the way back to the early Bronze Age, right? Almost 4,000 years old. Middle Bronze Age, we have about 3,500 years ago, we have a temple. It's a very important city. There's a destruction of the city around the time of Joshua, right? The late Bronze Age, and a rebuilding in the Iron Age around 975, which makes sense because we hear about Yeravam, right? Yeravam, the guy who makes the breakaway kingdom of Israel, he makes Shechem his capital in the beginning. So if it's rebuilt there, that makes sense. There's clearly much, much more to discover in the Tel of Shechem, but it is not something that is possible to do today. In Roman times, Shechem gets a new name. If you ever wondered why is Nabla Shechem, what's the connection between the two? So the Romans build up the city. They build it up onto the northern slope of Mount Gerizim. They actually build a monumental temple at the top, Tel Aras, okay, which is actually depicted on this coin from Shechem. Okay, it's at the top of this huge staircase. You have a temple called Tel Aras, and they call it New City, Neapolis, New City, Neapolis. Arabs have trouble pronouncing the letter P. P becomes B. Slur the words a little. Neapolis becomes Nablus. And that's how Shechem got the name Nablus, which doesn't seem intuitive at all, and it isn't. And today, both those names are used. Shechem has, like all cities, like all Arab cities since 1967, it has grown enormously. And if you look at the pictures, right, if you look at the old pictures of Shechem, it really is between the mountains, right? There it is. It's not built up on the slopes. But if you go to Shechem today, it is built all the way up on the slopes on either side. It is a much larger city. Just to give you some numbers, in 1961, Shechem was 46,000 people. Okay. In 2014, 146,500. Okay. So tripling in size. It's really kind of amazing. Shechem is obviously a town that is only Arab today, right? Under the Palestinian Authority. The Shomronim, the Samaritans, we're going to talk about in 1 minute. Used to live in Shechem, but as things heated up with the various intifadas, they moved out of the city of Shechem and up to the top of Mount Gerizim, and they don't live in Shechem anymore. So Shechem is a holy Palestinian city, except for Israeli soldiers who come in, and it has grown and grown greatly. Okay, let's talk a little about the tribes, whose tribes these are in this area, and the division of the kingdom, just for a moment. Sorry, I just want to see what I want to talk about here. Okay, so first of all, where's Shechem, right? So Shechem, and again, like we saw on this map last time, don't take it as gospel truth. Things change, but here's Shechem, ostensibly in the tribe of Menashe, but really kind of between Menashe and Ephraim. And here you really can see how it is very much the center, very important part, the middle of the country, okay? The tribes, as we're going to see next time we talk about the book of Judges, tribes are very independent, sometimes work together, sometimes don't. We have a unity under King David, under King Solomon, and then that all breaks up with Solomon's son, Rehoboam, who is too tough, right? He listens to the young advisors and not the old advisors, always listen to the old people over the young people, and he makes the taxes too onerous, and the people of Israel, led by Yeravam, right? There's Rehoboam and Yeravam. We're going to talk about this when we get to the book of Kings. The people of Israel, led by Yeravam, break away, create their own separate capital, a separate kingdom with Shechem as its capital. It doesn't remain the capital. There are other capitals. Meanwhile, the kingdom of Judah in the south, smaller, but it gets Jerusalem, right? So that's our division, and important to keep that in mind. And in some ways, kind of going back, the kingdom of Israel is going back to kind of a pre-Davidic reality, right? Without the story of Jerusalem, without the tribe of Judah, right? We're going back to the way things might have been before King David comes along and changes everything around. Okay, let's transition and talk a little about the story of the Samaritans, because we are in Samaria. So if you've only heard the word Samaritans from the phrase Good Samaritan, right? And if you see there's this great sign here on the left from somewhere in America, wherever you're, whatever you've done, whatever's been done to you, we're here for you, Samaritans, right? What is the Good Samaritan? It's based on the story in the New Testament where there's a man who's wounded, attacked and bleeding on the side of the road, and nobody will help him. A Kohen won't help him. A Levi won't help him. Who will help him? The Samaritan, which is essentially in Second Temple times, in the time of the New Testament, the lowest of the low. The Samaritans are way down on the totem pole. They are considered by the rabbis to be not even Jews, and they are very, very hostile to the Jews. They, as we're going to see in a second, consider themselves to be the true Jews, right? Who are the Samaritans? So their community is on Mount Gerizim today. And there are two different versions of where they came from. Okay. There's the Jewish version and there's the Samaritan version. Okay? The Jewish version is in the Book of Kings. Okay? And it takes place in the aftermath of the exile, right? The capture of the kingdom of Israel by the Assyrians, the exile of the 10 tribes, right? The Assyrians had a very clever policy. They would exile people from their land, but they didn't leave the land empty, because why should you leave the land empty? It's a good land. It can give you lots of produce, i.e. taxes and money. So what they would do is they would transfer populations. And that way the population didn't have any allegiance to the land that they were in. They would just work and provide income for the Assyrians. So that's what they do in Samaria, in the area of the 10 tribes. They brought people from Babylon, Kuta, Ava, Hamat, Sarvaim. This is why the rabbis, by the way, call the Samaritans the Kutim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria in place of the Israelites. But what happens when they first settled there? They did not worship the Lord. So the Lord sent lions against them, which killed some of them. And here is a very graphic depiction of the lions eating the people of Samaria. This is one of those, I think it's Gustave Doré who made all those very graphic, horrible pictures. Kind of interesting. So what do? Right? They don't know how to serve God, and God is angry at them. They said to the king of Assyria, "The nations which you deported and resettled in the towns of Samaria do not know the rules of the God of the land. Therefore, he has let lions loose against them." So what does the king say? "Send them one of the priests who we have deported. Let him dwell there. Let him teach them the practices of the God of the land." So the priest came, one of the priests came and settled in Beit El. He taught them how to worship the Lord. However, each nation continued to make its own gods and set them up in the cult places which have been made by the people of Samaria, right? So the way that the Bible looks at them, and then the rabbis later on, is they call them lion converts, gerei arayot. They're not sincere converts. They're only doing it to save themselves, and they keep a lot of their old practices. Now, what happens according to our story is that when the Jews are exiled to Babylonia, the Samaritans are not exiled. They stay on. And when the Jews come back, the Samaritans want to join with them. And this is the stories that we have in Ezra and Nehemiah. The Samaritans want to join with them. They want to build the temple with them. And the returnees look at them and they say, "Oh, you're not real Jews. We're not interested in you." And that's when the real schism takes place. Now, that's the Jewish version of the story. The Samaritan version of the story is very, very different. Okay? They see themselves as the true Jews, as the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh and Levi. Okay, they see their priests, they have priests, and they see them as descended in a straight line from Aaron, right? From Aaron in the desert, right? Moses' brother. And they have this great menorah where they show the actual descent and how their high priest today is a direct descendant of Aaron. And what they say is that we all started out together in Shechem, and then very early on, already in the time of Eli, in the time of the book of Samuel, the Israelites make a big mistake and they move the tabernacle from its rightful place near Mount Gerizim. They move it to Shiloh. And at that point is when the schism happens. We, the Samaritans, they say, we kept to the right way, and all the rest of you, you went in the wrong direction. You went off the derech, and you are all illegitimate, and we are the only true Jews. And that's the Samaritan story, very, very different from our story. They see Mount Gerizim as the holiest place. Hey, we see Mount Moriah. And in fact, the rabbis say, right, we actually have a masechet, a tractate in the Gemara, one of the small tractates called Masechet Kutim, all about the Samaritans. And it says, when will we accept them back? Because the rabbis are very aware that much of what the Samaritans do conforms to Jewish law. They say, when will we accept them back? When they reject Mount Gerizim and they accept Jerusalem, right? That's the real bone of contention, that they see the holy place as a very different place. Now, Gerizim is very important to them. Like I said, they used to live in Shechem, but After 1948, when Shechem becomes part of Jordan, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, the second president of Israel, in 1950 manages to bring a group of Samaritans out of the area of Shechem and to settle them in the town of Holon. Holon, south of Tel Aviv, very standard central Israel town, but he settles them there. And today, about half the community lives in Holon, and they have their own neighborhood, and their street signs include the Samaritan writing, which is similar to the ancient Hebrew writing, right? You can see it over here. About half of them live in Holon. About half of them live on Mount Gerizim. What are the numbers we're talking about here? We're talking about approximately 1,600 people total, right? About 800 in Holon, about 800 on Mount Gerizim. It is a tiny, tiny community. It went through periods where it was very, where it grew and it was very large. In temple times, Roman times, the Samaritans are a real force, but today they are a tiny, tiny community. Between 48 and 67, like I said, between 1950 and 67, they're cut in half, with half of the community living in Israel and half of them under Jordanian rule in Shechem. They are able to work out an agreement with Jordan because for them, going to Mount Gerizim is very, very important, particularly on Passover. We're going to see they do the Passover Pesach sacrifice, and they got permission to enter to go to Mount Gerizim for Pesach. And this is a picture of Samaritans getting ready to cross at the Mandelbaum Gate in Jordanian times. I love this picture. I love the guy with his little kumkum that he has to carry with him, his little kettle. And they go up to join their family that they were severed from once a year. They're allowed to go up on Mount Gerizim. What do they do? How are they different? What do they believe in? So first of all, they have Kohanim. They have priests, but unlike us, that the Kohanim is basically a very ceremonial and they give the Birkat Kohanim. But other than that, they're like everybody else. In the Samaritan community, the Kohanim are the leaders. They dress in a traditional way. We're going to see they have pride of place at the Passover sacrifice. They are very much the leaders of the community. They write in this old way that is reminiscent of the Ketav Ivri, of the ancient Hebrew writing that was used in First Temple times. That's what their Torahs look like. Their Torah is, like I said, almost identical to our Torah, not exactly. And they have the book of Joshua, but they don't have the other books. And they don't have rabbinical traditions. They don't follow that. They have their own interpretations of the law. They have five principles that are very nicely enunciated in this nice little catechism. Sorry for the phrase. Imanti b'cha Hashem, right? Belief in one God. Ubim Moshe ben Amram of Decha, and in Moses, the son of Amram, who for them is the super prophet, right? He's almost divine. Uba Torah Kedosha, right? We believe in the Torah. Uba Har Gerizim Beit El. Har Gerizim, right? Mount Gerizim is the place of God. Ubi Yom Nakam Vishilem, and in a judgment day, right? As in, there's going to be a next world. So those are their five beliefs, their five principles. Now, obviously, they have an oral law. It's just not the same oral law that Jews have, but they have to interpret the Torah, right? So when it says the mezuzot al beitecha, right, that you have to have the Torah written on your walls, they don't have a little mezuzah in their doorpost. They have the Torah written on their walls, right? They have either the Ten Commandments or the Shema written in a little plaque that they actually hang up above the door, okay? They don't wear tefillin, phylacteries, right? Because they say it's an ot ayadecha. It's a symbolic thing. It's supposed to be a sign on your hand, right? If this sounds a little like the Karaites, there are some similarities, but they are not the same. Their sukkah, as you can see here, first of all, it's inside because they were persecuted and they had to be protected. So that's already very strange. Their sukkah is decorated with fruit, because they connect the sukkah and the four species, and they say the two are together. And you have to decorate with a pre-Eitz Hadar, with beautiful fruits, okay? They don't have any electricity on Shabbat. They don't have a concept of bar mitzvah and reaching the age where you are commanded. They believe that everybody is commanded from birth. And so everyone past nursing infants fasts on Yom Kippur, and many, many other fascinating differences. And if you're interested in the history of the oral law and the development of the oral law, the Samaritans are amazing to visit because it's just a fascinating to see the distinctions. Their synagogues, they sit on the floor, they bow down, they prostrate themselves. Their mosaics, we have ancient Samaritan synagogues, look very much like Jewish synagogues, except they often have this imagery of a curtain that's pulled aside, okay? And they also have their writing is their special writing and not our writing. But perhaps the most famous thing about the Samaritans, certainly in Israel, is that on Passover, they do not gather around the dining room table or go to a Pesach program in Arizona. They all go up to Mount Gerizim and they do a sacrifice. They do the Zevach Pesach. Now, the way that the Samaritan calendar works, they also have leap years, like Jews do, like we have this year, except they're not on the same cycle as we are. So sometimes their Pesach comes out a month after the Jewish Pesach. And when that happens, thousands and thousands of people come up to watch this sacrifice because this is as close as you're going to get to what worship was like in the temple. Hey, they go to a special place where they, all the priests come, as you can see, they're decorated in these fabulous robes and everybody comes, the entire community comes, they come with these huge, lambs that they bring and everybody, every family has their own and they all slaughter them at exactly the same time and they put them in these deep pits. It is not for the faint of heart or for vegetarians, right? But it's a powerful thing and they roast them for hours and then late in the night, they all sit down and they eat their Passover sacrifice very much like we hear it described in the Mishnah and the Gemara. Okay, finally, at the peak of their community on Mount Gerizim is an archaeological site where we see the remains of their temple. Now, they believe that this is the holiest place, but they don't believe that what archaeologists have discovered as their temple is really the temple. They say it went up to heaven. It maybe it didn't exist on earth. They don't agree. But archaeologists pretty much agree that in the place where today there are the remains of a Byzantine church, and that's what you see most clearly in the picture here, this is built on top and essentially erases what was here before, which was the Samaritan temple, right? That they had, just like the Jews had a temple in Jerusalem, the Samaritans had a temple on Mount Gerizim. They say it's in this holy place towards the bottom of the site, but archaeologists have found at the center of the site, all kinds of things that seem to indicate that there is a temple. It has an east-west orientation, like the temple in Jerusalem. It has a monumental staircase going up to it, like the temple in Jerusalem. It has chambers for preparing the sacrifices. And of the artifacts that are found, right, there are a bunch of fascinating artifacts, including God's name, right, written in the ancient Hebrew script, including a bell, like what the priests had on the bottom of their robes, including over 400,000 kosher animal bone fragments, meaning you don't have that many bones unless you're doing lots of sacrifices mixed with ashes, okay? You have this strange looking thing, which is maybe a serpent. We know that there was a serpent in the temple, a copper serpent. Maybe that's what this is as well, right? And we have coins, and the coins help us to figure out when this temple was built, because the earliest coin goes back to 480 BCE, which is the time period of Ezra and Nehemiah. And we know from the book of Nehemiah that that is the time when the Samaritans build their temple. Okay, the Jews don't like that people are, Nehemiah doesn't like, the Jews are very happy, right? Nehemiah doesn't like all this intermarriage with other nations. And in fact, one of the priests, the Kohen Gadol, right, marries a non-Jewish woman, and he is Chatan Sambalat HaChorani. Sambalat HaChorani is a Samaritan, and he runs away, and he's chased away, and he makes a temple in Samaria. Okay, now we have the same story, a very similar story told by Josephus. He talks about it happening 100 years later. The coins show that it actually happens according to the book of Nehemiah. It happens in the time of the return to Zion. when the Samaritans break completely with the Jews and build their temple on Mount Gerizim, what happens? The Samaritans go through high points, low points. We have a lot of conflict with them in Second Temple times, in Mishnaic times. They're very powerful. And then the Byzantines come. They don't like them. And they destroy whatever was on Mount Gerizim, and they build a huge church on top of it to basically erase what was here before. So the Samaritan story is really, in some ways, it's a microcosm of the Jewish story, right? Of these ups and downs, these very difficult times. The Samaritans say, to their credit, that they have never left the land of Israel, right? Unlike the Jews who have gone into exile and come back or not come back, the Samaritans have never left the land of Israel. They have a serious issue of numbers. They're just not enough of them. They are a minority within the minority of Jews, and they're fascinating. So if you have a chance to go up to Mount Gerizim, it is very worthwhile. And the last thing I will show you is that the best tchina in Israel comes from the Samaritans on Mount Gerizim. Okay, Har Bracha Tchina is amazing. You go to the factory and they give it to you fresh, hot from the grindstones. So that's just a cool thing. All right, I see we have lots of questions or comments. Let's go see. Back to the top. Okay, what do we got here? Okay, sorry. The grave of the Sheikh, Sheikh Bilal, he died in Israel. Yeah, so all those Kivrei Sheikhim are unclear, right? It's the Muslim tradition. Is it really him? It's very hard to date such a thing, right? It's a stone building. It doesn't have any pottery. It doesn't have any bones. So it's very hard to know. It is definitely an old tradition, but I could not swear to you that it goes back to the 7th century. When I spent a Shabbat in El Amorah, I was told the same thing, right? It's very cool, right? Zartal shed blood for the land, the surveys of the land. Yes, Zartal is an amazing guy. Is there a radiocarbon date on the bone? On the bones. I would assume they would have tested that, and I don't know anything about it. I can look and find it. They found the scarabs, they found pottery, they found bones, they found ashes. Can the bones be dated? That I don't know. I don't know, I have to say. I can look into it. So how do you see Joshua's tomb? There is access to it, but it is not very often. The Breslov are very into going to, you said Joseph's tomb, Joshua's tomb, right? Joshua's tomb also, also buried in the same area. Kiffer Charis, also not easily accessible, but occasionally the army will allow people to go see it. Is there topographical continuity between Shechem and Megiddo? Right. So very interesting. The road, that road of Derech Avot does continue, but Har Eval, Mount Eval, is a very big mountain. And everybody's got to go around it, right? So you have to circumvent it in order to get up to the Jezreel Valley. Jezreel Valley is what we're going to talk about next time, so stay tuned. The Samaritans are what are known in the Talmud as Kutim, correct? Why were non-Jews expected to worship God? That's a very interesting question. We talk about Eretz Yisrael, right, the land of Israel, as this holy land, right, that will not tolerate any kind of idolatry. And that's why the Canaanites are kicked out. And I assume that is the theology behind what's going on in the Book of Kings. The leaders in Ezra's time were afraid the Samaritans would be a fifth column. There's a sense that there are religious objections as well as kind of political objections. There's definitely tension, and this is what we're going to come to at the very last class. We talk about Shivat Zion. There's tension between those who left and returned and those who stayed on both sides. Right. And we'll come back to that. Right. So didn't the rabbis trust? Yes. There's a very famous statement. I believe it's also in Masechet Kutim that says the mitzvot that the Samaritans do, they do better than the Jews. Right. So certain things we do trust them very strongly. Other things, not as much. Right. And that's because they understood how the halachot were different. Samaritans do not have a diaspora. They are only in the land of Israel. Right. So we do have this distinction of Samaritans who are Israeli and Samaritans who are not. And by the way, if you go up to Har Bracha and you talk to the Samaritans there and you ask them straight out, you know, are you supporters of Israel? Do you support the army? It's a very comfortable place. Jews go there. Soldiers go hole there, but they won't talk about it. They don't want to get in trouble. There's a small number of Samaritans living in Brazil and Italy. I do not know that. I am very curious to hear how you know that, but thank you. I've never heard about that. I don't know if their DNA has been tested. Is it a strictly patriarchal society? So they see, so that's actually a very interesting question. There's a million questions you could ask about the Samaritans, and I am not the world expert. There's actually a very interesting website that they have, Google Samaritans, and they have a lot of their laws. They have a very big marriage problem because they don't have enough people. And so they actually, I won't say proselytize, but they try to encourage women who are not Jewish to marry into Samaritan society. Women can marry in, men cannot marry in. Meaning women, it's the opposite of what we have, right? We say matrilineal, your Judaism goes by the mother. They say your Judaism, your Samaritanism goes by the father. Their bitter herbs are also interesting. They are going back to stuff that is in the land, right? Grasses that grow here. I'm not going to go through all of this. Anybody who's really interested in this, I wrote an article for Hadran, for the Daf Yomi website in Psachim. I wrote an article about the Samaritans and how their stuff compares to ours. So if you want to look that up, you are very welcome to. And anything else? You can get rid of the captioning yourself, I believe. I think.
Related to the Samaritans, Judy asks if they do Brit Milah on the eighth day.
Yes, they do, because that's a Torah law, right? But again, if you come to Israel, go up and do a tour with the Samaritans, because it's fascinating. Polygamy, I do not think so, but I don't remember. Yeah, they're all over the place. They're definitely mentioned by the rabbis, and there's lots to talk about with them. Sorry, I am going to cut it short, but there is a lot of interesting stuff out there about Samaritans. Another Torah in Motion class, you'll bring a Samaritan to speak. There are guys who come and teach about this, and it's great.
Oh, yeah. Karaites as well. So it is really interesting, yeah, that they're such a small communities, and yet they do really kind of try to teach about their traditions and stuff. Thank you so much, Shuli. It's a really, really great course. I think people who are, yes, super as usual. And I think that people who, you know, have been asking about kind of, Muslim pilgrimage sites in the area, as well as other sites, might be interested in a class that we have on Mondays at 11 a.m. Rabbi Dr. Lindsay Taylor Goodhartz is teaching an Introduction to Islam for Jews. And Rabbi Alex Israel is teaching a course on the Elijah narrative in Sefer Malachim right now. So, of course, some familiar things as well. That's on Thursdays at, I mean, sorry, not Thursdays. Today is Thursday. It's on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. And of course, tonight we have the Parsha Shir. That is Rabbi Benjamin J. Samuel's teaching for Parshat Yitro. Of course, Rabbi J. Kelmet is teaching his shiur on the Siddur tomorrow, and Rabbi Leibtag is teaching again on Sunday at 11:15 a.m. And we'll be looking at how to study a biblical book kind of in whole, looking at Sefer Shemot. So thank you so much. And I hope to see you again this week, next week. Have a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.